From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
He's a quintessential kiss-up, kick-down sort of guy. There are a lot of them around. I'm sure you've met them. But the fact is that he stands out, that he's got a bigger kick, and it gets bigger and stronger the further down the bureaucracy he's kicking.
The battle over two of President Bush's most controversial nominees continues. A former State Department intelligence chief says UN ambassador nominee John Bolton bullied analysts over intelligence. And John Negroponte, Bush's nominee to be the country's first director of national intelligence, comes under fire for his tenure as ambassador to Honduras.
When you compare what you wrote and what you testified to what the CIA said and what the Inter-American Court said, and what the Honduras Human Rights Commissioner said, there is a very big gap. It is almost as if you were an ambassador to a different country.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from home here in New York City. I'm Amy Goodman. John Bolton, President Bush's nominee to be the country's ambassador to the United Nations, was accused Tuesday of repeatedly abusing his power, intimidating intelligence analysts, and damaging the integrity of the State Department. The accusations came from Carl Ford, the State Department's former director of intelligence and research. Ford told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bolton was a, quote, kiss-up, kick-down sort of guy who, quote, abuses his authority with little people. Ford charged in 2002, Bolton directed an abusive tirade at analyst Christian Westerman for questioning Bolton's assertion that Cuba was developing biological and chemical weapons. Bolton later tried to have Westerman fired. Meanwhile, the Senate Intelligence Committee opened hearings Tuesday on the nomination of John Negroponte to become the country's first national intelligence director. If confirmed, Negroponte will oversee some 15 intelligence agencies and give the president's daily intelligence briefing. During the hearing, Negroponte vowed to, quote, push the envelope in asserting his authority overseeing the nation's intelligence agencies. He said the CIA would report to him and that he would assert control over the National Security Agency and other agencies. Negroponte is a career diplomat who's had five ambassadorships over the last 40 years. On Tuesday, he came under criticism for his tenure as ambassador to Honduras during the early 1980s. Documents surfaced this week that shed new light on how Negroponte supported the arming of the Contra rebels in Nicaragua to overthrow the Sandinista government. We'll have more on the Bolton and Negroponte hearings in just a few minutes. In Iraq, Al Jazeera is reporting U.S. airstrikes near the city of Al-Qaim have killed 20 Iraqis, injured 22 more. Among the dead were reportedly seven children, six women, three old men. Near Kirkuk, 12 members of the Iraqi National Guard have died in a roadside bombing. At the time, they were dismantling what turned out to be a decoy bomb. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says during his visit to Baghdad, the U.S. has no timetable for withdrawing its forces from Iraq. He said, quote, "We don't have an exit strategy. We have a victory strategy." One of the most notorious militant Cuban exiles applied Tuesday for political asylum in the United States. Luis Posada Carriles is a 77-year-old former CIA operative who was trained by the U.S. Army at Fort Benning in Georgia. He's been trying to violently overthrow Fidel Castro's government for four decades. 3 weeks ago, he entered the United States after years of hiding in Central America and the Caribbean. Posada has been connected to the 1976 downing of a civilian airliner that killed 73 passengers, of a series of 1997 bombings of hotels, restaurants, and discotheques in Havana that killed an Italian tourist, and a plot to assassinate Castro 5 years ago. In 1998, Posada told the New York Times, quote, "The CIA taught us everything. They taught us explosives, how to kill, bomb, trained us in acts of sabotage." On Tuesday, Democratic Congressmember William Delahunt of Massachusetts called for a federal investigation into how Posada entered the country. He also called for Posada to be arrested and deported. Delahunt said that if the U.S. facilitated Posada's entry into the country, it would, quote, obliterate America's credibility in the war on terrorism. Delahunt said if the U.S. grants Posada asylum, it would suggest, quote, that we share the views of those who support al-Qaeda and Iraqi insurgents, that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. The Justice Department has indicted British nationals in an alleged plot to attack financial buildings on the East Coast. They were charged with conspiring to use weapons of mass destruction, providing material support and resources to terrorists, and conspiring to damage and destroy buildings. The three men have been in British custody since last summer. A coalition of unions and public interest groups are meeting today to call on the House of Representatives to reject overhauling the nation's bankruptcy laws. Groups include the AFL-CIO, ACORN, the National Organization for Women, and Public Citizen. The Senate has already approved the rewriting of the nation's bankruptcy laws. The House is expected to vote on the measure as early as this week. Congressmember Jim McDermott assailed the bill Tuesday, describing it as a credit card company enslavement act of 2005. A new coalition called Debt Slavery is organizing rallies today in 14 cities across the country to protest the legislation. In other news from Washington, an FDA advisory panel voted 5-4 Tuesday to keep restrictions on the sale of silicone breast implants. In privacy news, the data collection company LexisNexis is now estimating 310,000 Americans had their personal data stolen after the company's computer systems were hacked. The figure is 10 times higher than the company's original estimate. LexisNexis collects and stores detailed personal information about nearly every person in the country. Meanwhile, Tufts University has sent a letter to some 100,000 alumni warning them that their personal information may have been stolen from a computer database used for fundraising. In Chicago, protesters plan to gather today outside the shareholders' meeting of bulldozer manufacturer Caterpillar. Solidarity protests are also scheduled in 40 cities around the world. The activists, led by Stop Cat Coalition, are calling on Caterpillar to stop selling bulldozers to the Israeli military. Israel's used the bulldozers to level thousands of homes owned by Palestinians. 2 years ago, U.S. activist Rachel Corrie died after being run over by a Caterpillar-manufactured bulldozer. Last month, Corrie's family filed a lawsuit against Caterpillar, alleging the company broke international law by providing specially designed bulldozers to the Israeli military with full knowledge that the equipment would be used to demolish homes and endanger civilians. Inside today's meeting, dissident shareholders are expected to introduce a resolution calling on the company to investigate whether its sale of bulldozers to Israel violates its own worldwide code of business conduct. In New York, the city school system has transferred an assistant principal accused of humiliating a group of Haitian students. The administrator, Nancy Miller, reportedly ordered more than a dozen Haitian students to sit on the floor during lunchtime and eat chicken and rice with their bare hands. Miller reportedly screamed at the students, saying, quote, "In Haiti, they treat you like animals, and I'll treat you the same way here." After the incident, students say school administrators tried to bribe and coerce them into changing their story. Parents from the Haitian community have called on the school system to fire Miller and the school's chief principal. Although the incident occurred on March 16th, Miller remained at the school until Tuesday. Her transfer came as dozens of parents picketed outside the school. And in Chicago, the Secret Service sent two agents last week to the opening of an art exhibit at a school-run gallery at Columbia College. The target of the investigation was a piece titled Patriot Act. It depicts a sheet of mock postage stamps that show President Bush with a gun pointed at his head. Last spring, Secret Service agents in Washington State questioned a high school student about anti-war drawings he did for an art class. One drawing depicted Bush's head on a stick. And in Albany, New York, Democratic state lawmakers blocked a Republican move to reinstate the death penalty in the state. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. It's great to be home here in New York. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill on Tuesday, the battle over two of President Bush's most controversial nominees continued. John Negroponte, Bush's nominee to be the Director of National Intelligence, appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee. As with his previous confirmation hearings, Negroponte faced little in the way of tough questioning, though there were some moments where he clashed with senators. Later in the program, we'll hear some of the questioning of Negroponte and take a closer look at his past. But we begin with the other major hearing on Capitol Hill. That's the confirmation hearing of John Bolton, Bush's nominee for UN ambassador. But it wasn't Bolton who appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Many eyes and ears in Washington focused in on the testimony of Carl Ford, the former director of intelligence and research at the State Department. In just under 3 hours of testimony, Ford denounced Bolton as a, quote, kiss-up, kick-down sort of guy who, quote, abuses his authority with little people. Ford charged that in 2002, Bolton directed an abusive tirade at analyst Christian Westerman for questioning whether Cuba was developing biological and chemical weapons. Ford characterized the incident as shaking the foundation of the Intelligence Bureau and said it prompted Secretary of State Colin Powell to intervene. Ford said shortly after the incident, Powell visited the Bureau to assure its employees they should continue to, quote, speak truth to power. After being sworn in, Ford began his testimony.
Mr. Chairman, it's customary for me to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to come before the Foreign Relations Committee and present my views. Thankful is not the emotion that I'm feeling this morning. It's a very awkward situation for me to be in. I was raised with the admonition that if you can't find something good to say about somebody, you don't say anything at all. And God knows I haven't lived up to that high ideal throughout my life, but I've always tried, and even to this day, it's an important principle in the way that I conduct myself. It's also awkward because I consider myself to be a loyal Republican and conservative to the core. I'm a firm and enthusiastic supporter of President Bush and his policies, and I'm a huge fan of Vice President Cheney, who I worked with when he was Secretary of Defense. So the notion of coming before you and making critical remarks about a presidential nominee is not something I take lightly, not something that I haven't done a lot of soul searching on, and clearly it's one of the more difficult assignments I've been given. I also have to admit that I'm conscious that I might not be completely objective about Secretary Bolton. I was a party to the confrontation the Secretary had with INR. I was a bit player, to be sure, but I was directly involved. And at the end of the day, you'll have to decide whether my assessment is fair and balanced.
That was Carl Ford, the former Director of Intelligence and Research, INR, at the State Department, testifying Tuesday at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. After a few brief remarks from Republican Senator Richard Lugar, Ford addressed the controversial Bolton incident.
I can guarantee you, though, if Secretary Bolton had chosen to come to me, or in my absence, my principal deputy, Secretary Tom Finger, I wouldn't be here today. He could have approached me in the same tone and in the same attitude, shaking his finger, red in the face, high tone in his voice, and I wouldn't be here today. If he had gone to Secretary Powell or Secretary Armitage and complained loudly about the poor service that he was receiving from INR and the terrible treatment that he'd been stabbed in the back by one of INR's analysts, I wouldn't be here today. The fact is that It's appropriate if someone is unhappy with the service they're getting from one of the service organizations in a bureaucracy, that they should complain. They should yell as loud as they want to yell. But instead of doing any of those three things, Secretary Bolton chose to reach five or six levels below him in the bureaucracy, bring an analyst into his office, and give him a tongue lashing. And I frankly don't care whether he sang scat for 5 minutes. The attitude, the volume of his tone, and what I understand the substance of the conversation, he was so far over the line that he's one of the sort of memorable moments in my 30 plus year career. Unfortunately, those two moments that he's given me are very negative. That is, I've never seen anybody quite like Secretary Bolton. Doesn't even come close. I don't have a second and third or fourth in terms of the way that he abuses his power and authority with little people. I say that because if you bark back at him, he doesn't bother you anymore. And anyone who has either generally the same rank or even a step or so below, they don't have so much to fear. We can defend ourselves. There are a lot of screamers that work in government. But you don't pull somebody so low down in the bureaucracy that they're completely defenseless. It's an 800-pound gorilla devouring a banana. The analyst was required simply to stand there and take it. And Secretary Bolton knew when he had the tirade that, in fact, that was the case. Now, I would argue that that action by itself certainly brings real questions to my mind about his suitability for high office. But it was also that person was an analyst, an intelligence analyst. And it's clear that there is a difference of opinion in the way people look at political pressure. And if you don't mind, I'd like to take just a moment and wander off on political pressure before I finish my answer to my question.
Mr. Chairman, just a
Virginia Republican
point of clarification.
George
Allen. The analyst was who? Now, is this Westerman you're talking about?
Senator, I frankly don't like the idea of my analyst being named and argued about in public. He didn't do anything wrong. If you have a complaint with him, talk to me. If you don't believe what I say, talk to me.
I'm just trying to understand, Mr. Ford, just trying to get the chronology and who.
It was an analyst at INR.
This is not the...
Is this Mr.
Smith?
Is it Mr. Westerman?
It was an analyst at INR. I actually believe that you're off on the wrong track when people start taking a guy way down in the bureaucracy just doing his job and start making him the issue. He could have done everything wrong. Everything. He could have been 150% wrong. It does not justify the treatment he received from a superior officer. I've never seen it in my career. I don't think that any of you have seen it before. Unfortunately, my judgment, my opinion, he's a quintessential kiss-up, kick-down sort of guy. There are a lot of them around. I'm sure you've met them. But the fact is that he stands out, that he's got a bigger kick, and it gets bigger and stronger the further down the bureaucracy he's kicking. And he stands out. I don't have any other examples to give you of someone who acts this way.
Carl Ford yesterday at the hearing, the Democrats on the Foreign Relations Committee emphasized that the incident described by John Bolton is just one example of this conduct and said they could provide more witnesses. The New York Times noted Carl Ford's testimony offered an extraordinary public glimpse into the long-running and raw intelligence wars within the Bush administration, pitting hawks like Bolton, a protege of Vice President Dick Cheney, against the more more circumspect intelligence operatives at the State Department, who, among other differences, had cast doubt on some pre-war claims about Iraq. Democrats charge Bolton's actions have grave and far-reaching implications for U.S. credibility, while Republicans painted it as an isolated incident. After break, we'll go to California Senator Barbara Boxer. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. Well, why don't we go to Barbara Boxer right now?
I want to put something new into the record here that was written before we knew that John Bolton was going to be nominated to this position. And I hope you read it, and I hope Senator Chafee in particular reads it, because what this is about is a way bigger picture, Mr. Ford. And you're mentioned in this particular article, by the way, in a good way, so don't worry. It ran in the Washington Monthly. It's called Analyze This. And I ask unanimous consent to place the whole story in the record.
You're placed in the record in full.
Now, the thesis here by the writer is that the INR is the best intelligence agency we have, that they have been closest to right of all the intelligence agencies. And they look at, he looks at the Iraq situation as a specific case in point. And he says, indeed, on the whole question of Iraq's nuclear capabilities, INR came consistently closer to the truth than did other agencies. And he goes on and says, they don't just tolerate dissent there, they actually encourage it. So it's the different culture than what we're used to in the CIA. And here's a couple of other quotes. And an important reason for INR's success is that the agency has a culture that tolerates dissent. The lasting criticism of the CIA and the 9/11 Commission produced was the agency's tendency to shoehorn evidence to fit the results that the higher-ups desired. And it goes on. Remember, David Kaye, the chief American arms inspector after the war, told the New York Times the tubes were the only piece of physical evidence about the Iraqi weapons program that they had, and that the INR was the only one to back the Department of Energy when they said the tubes could not be used for nuclear weapons. And then, just to finish my quotes here, a culture of dissent must be nurtured and protected if it is to thrive, and state has usually given INR the requisite political insulation. Another part of the reason for INR's insulation has to do with the kind of people who have led it. INR analysts give former INR Director Ford, for instance, tremendous credit for shielding the Bureau from political pressure. Quote, Carl earned the respect of the people in the Bureau for standing up for the work of the Bureau. And then it says, not everyone in Washington is a fan of INR. Many neoconservatives, especially, see the agency as a threat to the more vigorous military projects that they advocate. Mr. Chairman, the reason this is such an important point is it's really central. This is not one isolated incident. It's three incidents. And it fits into the larger pattern of whether we're going to have an intelligence community that is free from political pressure, whether it comes from me or from you or from Mr. Bolton or anyone else. And the fact that Mr. Bolton tried to say it wasn't a big deal and he shrugged it off fades in the light of this testimony. And the fact that we learned today that Secretary Powell actually mentioned the name of this analyst and came over to the State Department. So anyone who was fooling himself into thinking, you know, this all came out all right, there's no there, is essentially fooling himself. Because bottom line, again, is this was pressure, heavy duty pressure, inappropriate pressure applied to a line analyst here. And thank goodness that analyst did have the character to stand up to it and that he had someone like you, Mr. Ford, to say, knock it off, even to as big a bully as Mr. Bolton is. And I think Mr. Bolton needs anger management at the minimum. And he doesn't deserve to be promoted based on this alone, let alone all of his comments about how the UN doesn't exist and it should lose 10 floors and no one would care. That aside, which is bewildering in itself, this is, based on this testimony, I think, explosive. And I hope this committee will tell the president, Mr. Bolton is your friend, he's a strong partisan, you can use him, but not in the job of the United Nations.
California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer at the John Bolton confirmation hearings on Tuesday. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Slow Bicycle by Moom here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we broadcast in over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and Link TV on DirecTV Channel 375. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Ray McGovern, he was with the Central Intelligence Agency for more than a quarter of a century. He was one of the top daily briefers for George H.W. Bush when he was vice president. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you respond to the whole scenario yesterday of Carl Ford, the significance of him coming forward and testifying?
Yeah. Well, just listening to your clips, I heard the whole thing yesterday, but listening to your clips, I'm getting the idea that there's a little taste of Democracy Now! Coming in here. It's really good to have this kind of information aired so the public can judge what kinds of pressures intelligence analysts have been put to over the last couple of years. Needless to say, I admire Carl Ford very, very much. He is appropriately protective of the people who work in his organization, people who are really under more fire than anyone else. Why? Well, because they didn't have the same ideological proclivities as the so-called neoconservatives, and they wouldn't heal. They wouldn't bow. Witness the fact that in that famous or infamous estimate back dated October 1, 2002, they took a footnote saying this uranium from Niger business is a canard, and the story is, quote, highly dubious. They dismissed the aluminum tubes canard, siding with Department of Energy and saying, look, the specifications are exactly what they need for conventional artillery. And worst of all, when they were asked to predict when Iraq's nuclear weapons program was likely to yield a nuclear weapon, they said, well, you know, we really can't predict that because we can't predict the end of a program that we don't see as having started. There's no evidence that Dick Cheney is correct in saying this program was reconstituted. So you get a little idea of why a fellow like Bolton would get all red in the face when he's faced by junior people who stick to their guns and say, look, we're going to call it the way we see it. We don't care what your grade is.
Ray McGovern, the significance of Secretary of State Colin Powell intervening and what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very unusual. And again, it's very much to his credit. He did pretty much give INR free rein. Now, it would have been nice if he heeded their analysis more because as I've just said, they were right on a lot of things, and specifically on things that Powell was wrong on when he went before the world and the UN on February 5, 2003. But he did have the right instincts, and I applaud Carl Ford as well for inviting the secretary down to give a little morale and pep talk to the folks, because clearly there was this chilling effect. Clearly the analysts were fearful of their careers if they would be subjected to the kinds of things that Westerman was subjected to. Now, what's really striking, and, you know, I have great admiration for INR, the State Department Intelligence Unit, and I've worked with them very closely for those 27 years. Cooperatively, I might say, we really learned a lot from them and they from us. Now, take the situation at CIA during precisely the same time. We know that Vice President Cheney was visiting the CIA regularly to make sure that their analysis was good, you see. Now, people ask me, was that unusual? And I said, no, that wasn't unusual. That was unprecedented. Never in my 27 years there did a vice president come to the agency on a working visit. We would always go down to him. So the fact that he made multiple visits, and curiously enough, the director of analysis didn't know how many. She said, well, between 5 and 8, which suggests to me that Vice President Cheney was turned loose on analysts just as junior as Mr. Westerman. Now, the cardinal sin here, in my view, is that George Tenet had every responsibility to prevent that from happening to his analysts. If George Tenet had the kind of integrity that Carl Ford had, Carl Ford, as you well discerned, was incredibly outraged at this attempt to prostitute the intelligence product. Now, if George Tenet was any way like Carl Ford, he would have protected his analysts from this kind of pressure. And it wasn't only Cheney. The likes of Newt Gingrich would go up there from the defense board there that he serves on and make sure that their analysis was in tune with what Cheney and others wanted. So you have a real contrast here. You have the analysts at the CIA receiving not only no protection, but every encouragement to not tell it like it is, but tell it like the administration wants it to be. And on the other hand, you have the State Department with a fellow like Carl Ford, who adheres to the long tradition of intelligence professionals who stand up to that kind of pressure. And if they encounter it more and more, they go to the boss and they go to the Secretary of State and say, look, if you want to hear it straight from us, you've got to protect us from the likes of John Bolton.
We're talking to Ray McGovern with the CIA for more than a quarter of a century. As we turn now to another Senate confirmation hearing that was held on Tuesday in Washington, and that was John Negroponte, Bush's nominee to be the country's first national intelligence director. If confirmed, Negroponte will oversee 15 intelligence agencies and give the president's daily intelligence briefing. Negroponte is a career diplomat who's had 5 ambassadorships over the last 40 years. Most recently, he served as the ambassador to Iraq, and before that, the ambassador to the United Nations, where he made the case for the invasion of Iraq. But it's his time as ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985 that earned him a reputation for supporting widespread human rights abuses and campaigns of terror. During his tenure, Honduras was the staging ground for the Contra War in Nicaragua and the home of the brutal CIA-backed Battalion 316, which is responsible for the deaths and disappearances of many Hondurans. Earlier this week, documents surfaced that shed new light on Negroponte's connection to the Iran-Contra scandal. The newly declassified cables and memos were obtained by the Washington Post under the Freedom of Information Act. They reveal, after the House voted in July 1983 to halt all aid to the anti-Sandinista-Contras, Negroponte responded by sending a cryptic message to the president's national security advisor and director of Central Intelligence, urging them to keep the secret arms deal alive. At the confirmation hearing on Tuesday, Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia asked Negroponte about the documents.
Mr. Ambassador, this morning's paper indicated the State Department released hundreds of documents related to your time in Honduras. This question, as you know, is bound to come. The committee has not had a chance to review those documents. I'm not sure that there's anything new in those documents, but let me ask you a couple of questions about the report. According to the article, immediately after the House voted to cut off funding to the Contra rebels, you sent a cable expressing continued support for this policy. Were you advocating continuing of some kind of aid to the Contras after the congressional cutoff of funds? What was the purpose of this cable? And I might go on to say, the Post describes back-channel messages. Can you describe what this back-channel was as opposed to the normal State Department cable traffic method?
Senator, first and foremost, with respect to the question of support for the Contras, whatever activities I carried out, whatever courses of action I recommended in Honduras were always entirely in consistent with applicable law at the time. So if your question is whether I ever undertook any activity or made any recommendation that was inconsistent with legal prohibitions that existed at various times, known as the Boland Amendment, I was made every effort to scrupulously comply with that amendment. Secondly, as far as the material is concerned, if I read the story correctly, and I haven't had an opportunity to look at the cables to which the Washington Post refers, but it sounds to me like the same set of cables. It was my chronological file, my file of cables that I had personally drafted, which was declassified and made available to the Foreign Relations Committee prior to my hearings to be Ambassador of the United Nations in 2001. The committee also reviewed this very same matter in practically microscopic detail in 1989 when I was nominated to be ambassador in Mexico, and I think in both instances found that I had not carried out any improper behavior. And I certainly believe that I was, my comportment was always in an absolutely legal and entirely professional manner.
I thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Senator Jay Rockefeller did not have a follow-up question. Joining us to talk about John Negroponte is Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst at the National Security Archive, a public interest documentation center in Washington. The newly declassified documents on John Negroponte are posted on their website. He joins us from our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peter Kornbluh.
It's a pleasure to be here, Amy.
Well, can you talk about these documents and what they say?
This is a collection of about 450 cables and memos that, as you just heard, John Negroponte personally wrote and kept in a file known as the Cron file. They essentially contain the nuts and bolts of his daily and at times hourly work as ambassador to Tegucigalpa during one of the most controversial periods in the recent history of U.S. foreign policy, the Contra War period against Nicaragua. And you really do get a sense of his latitude, his breadth, the number of things he was involved in, from counseling the Hondurans on how to push back the peace process that was being pushed by other countries such as Mexico and Venezuela to stop the Contra War and bring peace to the region, negotiating with the Honduran military on military bases, being the most forceful advocate and strategic planner in Honduras for the Contra operation itself. So they're quite revealing about him, about his personality, and about his actions at the time.
he's trying to suggest that this is old news. This is stuff that came out before when the confirmation hearings for him for U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Can you talk about the significance of what you've gotten? Now, this was just gotten under the Freedom of Information Act.
He asked for this file to be declassified and given to him in 1998 when he retired from the Foreign Service and went into private practice for a few years. This was somewhat before he was nominated to be UN ambassador. It was actually in 1998, the last 2 years of the Clinton administration. And he kept this file. It was declassified but not publicly released, which is a big distinction here in Washington. And the Washington Post, getting ready for these hearings that went on yesterday and will continue, I guess, asked for this file to be actually released to them, and it was turned over. This is really the first time that the public, you and I and your listeners, your viewers, are getting a chance to actually digest, read from his own pen, from his own typewriter, Negroponte's accounts of his meetings with Honduran military officials, his talks with other U.S. government officials, and it's an important file. It's important to understand his personality as he's being considered for this incredibly important job in Washington. And frankly, it's very important because 20 years after these documents were written, we are able to use them to revisit the Contra War, which too many people in this country have forgotten about.
Can you talk about the significance of the document that came out that said the day after the House voted to halt all aid to the Contras, John Negroponte urged the president's national security advisor and director of central intelligence to hang tough. The July 1983 memo to the men running the Contra war against Nicaragua contained, as the Washington Post said, in a single cryptic sentence, "Hondurans believe special project is as important as ever." The significance of this, Peter Kornbluh, and what that term special project means.
Well, special project was the euphemism that he used in this cable traffic, which some of this cable traffic was through direct channels. It wasn't, some of it was back channel to the CIA, but others wasn't. So they really didn't refer to the code names of the CIA covert war. He generally referred to it as, quote, special project, unquote. But basically, you have to remember that there was a series of votes in Congress, and in fact, in 1983, Congress in the end didn't fully shut down the Contra War. They voted to put a $24 million cap on CIA spending for the Contra War, and so Negroponte is basically saying, well, okay, this vote went against us, but here I'm in Honduras, and I'm going to continue to tell the Hondurans that this thing isn't over. They really are counting on continuing support for the FDN, the main Contra force based here in Honduras, and we need to bolster them. They want to see this continue, and that's basically what he's saying there. Let's make some lemonade out of lemons at this point. The more important cables, frankly, are later in 1984 and 1985, when Congress actually does pass the final Boland Amendment, terminates all aid to the Contra War. I have a cable with me here, Amy, where
you are listening to Peter Kornbluh, who is joining us in our Washington studio. We've lost transmission for a moment, and we're going to take this moment to take a break and then come back to him. Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, working with the Washington Post in getting these documents under the Freedom of Information Act that say, among other things, that the day after the House voted to halt aid to the Contras, that John Negroponte urged the president's national security advisor and CIA director to hang tough. We'll come back with Peter Kornbluh and other guests in just a minute.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking about John Negroponte and his tenure before he was ambassador to Iraq, before he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, when he was ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985. Newly released documents show that John Negroponte was active in a U.S. effort to support the Contras, despite the fact that the House had voted to cut all aid to the Contras. Our guest in studio in Washington is Peter Kornbluh, who is with the National Security Archive, has been releasing numerous documents over the years, gotten under the Freedom of Information Act, and putting them on the National Security Archive website, where the latest documents are also displayed. Peter Kornbluh, you were just talking about what you thought was even more important than this memo that Negroponte had sent to the National Security Advisor and Director of Central Intelligence to hang tough with that cryptic single sentence. Hondurans believe special project is important as ever. Secret project, code for the secret arming of the Contra rebels from bases in Honduras. What was more important than that?
Well, a year later, in 1984, when Congress, led by Massachusetts Congressman Edward Boland, did actually vote to shut down all aid to the Contras, you then have Negroponte saying to the Hondurans, don't do anything irreversible to kick the Contras out of Honduras. We have a cable here from August of 1984, which I'll just share with your viewers and listeners. He says he's reporting back on his conversation with the president of Honduras. The ambassador mentioned success that the FDN, the Contra Force, is having in obtaining additional funding through private sources. Ambassador explicitly urged that the government of Honduras do anything to deprive the Contras of their Honduran support base at a time when their position inside Nicaragua appears to have improved substantially. The ambassador insisted on the point that the government of Honduras do nothing irreversible to the FDN in the weeks and months ahead. In other words, Negroponte was our point man. Negroponte was our point man in making sure that the Hondurans didn't kind of bolt from this long-standing covert program in which their nation was being used as a territorial base for the Contra War. In fact, even though he says to the Hondurans there's private sources now funding the Contra War, in fact, this was the Reagan administration kind of basically holding out a tin cup to Saudi Arabia and a number of other countries, asking them to secretly and illegally provide money to sustain the Contra War after Congress had cut off aid.
Peter Kornbluh with us of the National Security Archives. Peter, can you talk about, as we talk about all the memos, what was happening in Honduras in terms of human rights abuses? Why what we're seeing here flies in the face of what people would consider, deals with grave human rights abuses. What was the scene in Honduras at that time, and what was John Negroponte's role in it?
The Honduran military, led by Commander Gustavo Alvarez between 1981 and 1984, was essentially the power behind the throne. Honduras had a civilian president. He was very weak, Roberto Suazo Cordova, and widely considered to be a front for the military, for Alvarez himself. Negroponte was very, very fond of Gustavo Alvarez and his second-in-command, Colonel Buesa Rosa, Jose Buesa Rosa, because they were very cooperative in the Contra war effort. They allowed the United States to use Honduran air bases to construct new bases that the CIA used to run the Contra war, and they were ideologically very much involved with us. And in return, almost as a reward, Negroponte is reporting back to Washington on these military officers that they were very professional, articulate military men. And on Alvarez, he sends this extraordinary cable in the spring of 1984, I believe it was, saying that Alvarez is a constitutionalist and supports the democratic process. 5 months after he writes this cable, Alvarez is pushed out as commander for, quote, authoritarian tendencies by the military officers under him. And Buesa Rosa, who Negroponte was also very fond of, eventually sells cocaine to drug suppliers to raise money to actually try and assassinate his civilian president, Suaso Cordoba, and eventually ends up in jail here in the United States of America. These guys were thugs. They were involved in all sorts of human rights atrocities. More than 200 people disappeared at the hands of the Honduran military and the Contras themselves in Honduras between 1981 and 1984. But none of these 450 cables, not a single one of them, actually reports back on the truth of these human rights abuses. Out of all these cables, there's only one from 1985 after Alvarez has left that is totally devoted to the issue of human rights. And in that cable, basically Negroponte is saying, well, we don't have any evidence of these newspaper allegations, claims that Newsweek magazine and the New York Times is making about these atrocities.
We're talking to Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. We're also joined on the telephone from New Mexico by Tom Barry. He's policy director of the International Relations Center, founder of Foreign Policy and Focus as well. He lived for a number of years in Honduras during Negroponte's tenure as ambassador. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. You've written a piece, Negroponte and the CIA's Eclipse, Rest Assured, Will Now Have Good Intelligence. Can you amplify what Peter Kornbluh has said and talk about the significance of these hearings?
Well, I think the significance is, and one, it's a really an old story in the 80s, and I think that Barbara Boxer really pointed out that the main issue, what's happening here, is that both Bolton and Negroponte are part of a conspiracy, an agenda against the liberal establishment, that they feel that the CIA, the State Department, they need to be overhauled, and that Negroponte and Bolton are good choices to do that. They've long felt that the United Nations, the CIA, and the liberals at the State Department have stood in the way of good foreign policy, and so that's one point. Another is that both of them are masters of deceit. They follow a foreign policy agenda, and the truth is not the issue. What is the issue is victory. And that's a whole philosophy of intelligence that both subscribe to. That good intelligence is policy driven intelligence, is strategic intelligence, and the truth doesn't matter. And looking at Negroponte, that Negroponte is a hawk. It's not just in the case of Central America where he was ambassador, but going back to his days in Vietnam, he disputed the peace process in Vietnam with Kissinger, and again in Iraq. That this man believes that the United States should exercise military power and it opposes peace processes, whether they be in Central America or Vietnam or the settlement of the Iraq conflict.
You were in Honduras. Can you talk about what was happening then, and can you talk about that period of John Negroponte?
Certainly. That all this news and this cable, anyone who was in Honduras saw it happening. I spoke to the families of husbands that were disappeared. Spoke to the military, went to the Contra camps, the refugee camps. It was all readily evident that the U.S. Embassy was coordinating, and it wasn't just for the Contras, remember, that Honduras was a logistical center for the whole intervention in Central America through the Pomerola Air Base, that they were supporting operations in El Salvador and Nicaragua and to some extent in Guatemala, that Negroponte was quite adept at, not unlike Bolton, of keeping his mouth shut, but he was a perfect foreign policy operator and contributed to the success of U.S. operations and supporting counter-revolutionary activities in Nicaragua and counterinsurgency activities in El Salvador and Guatemala. Deaths, disappearances were widespread. The military was cooperating closely with the Contras and not only supporting the Contras, but eliminating the leftist opposition in Honduras.
I want to go back in this last minute of the program to Peter Kornbluh on a different issue, but one that's in the headlines today. One of the most notorious militant Cuban exiles applied yesterday for political asylum in the United States. Luis Posada Carriles is the former CIA operative who was trained at U.S. Army at Fort Benning, Georgia, has been trying to violently overthrow Fidel Castro's government for 4 decades. 3 weeks ago, he entered the U.S. after years of hiding in Central America and the Caribbean. Peter Kornbluh, it's on another subject, but can you comment on this latest news?
This is going to be the major test of George Bush's war against terrorism. He has a renowned and legendary anti-Castro terrorist who served many years and is a fugitive from justice for having broken out of jail, bribed his way out of jail in Venezuela for blowing up a Cubana Airlines jet in 1976 and killing 73 people aboard that plane, including the entire Cuban Olympic fencing team. He has been involved in the hotel bombings in the late 1990s in Havana, which killed an Italian tourist. He was arrested and imprisoned for 4 years in Panama for an attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro 5 years ago, which was in which he was going to use 20 pounds of C4 explosives. It could have killed many, many people. He is a renowned terrorist, but he got most of his training for these activities from the CIA, and we have documents on that in the mid-1960s. And in fact, now he's going to ask for asylum here in the United States, claiming that he was worked for the CIA and advanced U.S. interests in the 60s and 70s. So if George Bush is going to be true to his principles on fighting the war on terrorism, he will deport this renowned terrorist back to Venezuela, where he will be re-imprisoned. He broke out of prison in 1985 and, ironically, went to Central America to work for Oliver North secretly in the Contra War effort. However, Bush does not deport him and gives him asylum, that will be an incredible indication of a double standard, if you will, at minimum, on the issue of international terror.
Peter Kornbluh, how do you think he got into the United States?
I think there's many ways for him to slip into the United States. It's hard to know whether somebody looked the other way or whether he came across the border at some point or whether there was a quiet deal reached on this. I guarantee you that the National Security Archive will be seeking to get all the documents about his arrival here and this whole process declassified so that we know, because this is truly a test of U.S. policy on the issue of international terrorism. You can't say that one man is allowed to blow up an airplane and kill 73 innocent people because he ideologically is in keeping with the president's position on undermining and overthrowing the Castro government in Cuba. A terrorist is a terrorist, and Luis Posada, frankly, has one of the longest careers in terrorism of any individual alive today.
Well, I want to thank you, Peter Kornbluh, for joining us, editor of Bay of Pigs Declassified, the secret report on the invasion of Cuba, also author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability, senior analyst at the National Security Archive, Public Interest Documentation Center in Washington. We'll link to it on our website at democracynow.org. Also, Tom Barry, policy director of the International Relations Center and founder of Foreign Policy in Focus. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Tonight, I'll be at Cooper Union with Tariq Ali and other speakers. Tomorrow night at Changing Hands in Phoenix, and on Friday in Baltimore, Saturday in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Sunday in Taos. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.